In the town where I was born.
This is the second season in the Nine Row Chronicles, a podcast series from the people behind CelticUnderground.net, detailing out the first Nine in a Row trophy haul, title haul that happened in Scottish football. Of course, we all know the history of the second season, season 66-67, when Celtic became the first non-Latin team to win the European Cup, and in the process also cleared up and won every trophy and title that they entered that season. And it was all done by a group of players, 11 players, who were born within 30 miles of the stadium within which they were based. The most remarkable season in the history of British football. As I say, we all know the history of that, but this podcast is there to put a bit more meat on the bones. In the podcast, we tell you all about the films that were leading at the box office at the time, and also, obviously, in detail about the games that they played. If you're wondering why the Yellow Submarine's playing in the background, if you didn't listen to the first one, what we're having is the bookending of each episode as the number one at the time. So we start with the number one when the domestic season kicked off, and that was Yellow Submarine by the Beatles, and then we finish with the number one at the time of the end of the season. Now, obviously, I could have picked the end of the league season, but decided to pick the end of the season of competitive games, which of course includes the 25th of May 1967, and number one at that point was Silence is Golden by the Tremolos, so you'll hear that at the end of the podcast. There's another podcast that will come shortly after this one, which is specifically about the night in Lisbon when the Lions devoured Catenaccio, and that is the Human Torpedo, commentary of the goals, commentary of the post-match action. Anyway, that's enough of me. This is me, Harry Brady, and I'm joined by Robert and St. Anthony.
We all live in the Yellow Submarine.
So last week we did the start of the first nine in a row with the 65-66 season. Now it is the most momentous season in the club's history. It's 66-67 season, and I'm joined once again by Stephen and St. Anthony and Robert. Again, to give some context, I'll tell you one of the things I've noticed, guys. Because I looked at the films for 65, then I looked at the films for 66, and I've looked at the films for 67. Films seem to go in two-year cycles. Good film years, bad film year, good film year. Because see, if you look at 66, top grossing films in 1966 in the United States and Canada were The Bible in the beginning, Hawaii, Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf, The Sand Pebbles, A Man for All Seasons, The Good, the Bad and the Ugly, Lieutenant Robin Crusoe, some Disney film, The Russians Are Coming, The Russians Are Coming, Grand Prix and Blow Up, yet 1967 in film is The Graduate, The Jungle Book, Bonnie and Clyde, The Dirty Dozen, Valley of the Dolls, You Only Live Twice, To Serve With Love. So, obviously it goes 1 year good, 1 year bad in films. But that's a bit of context of films. We've got the 66-67 season with Celtic, which started off in the league with a 3-0 away victory to Clyde after the group stages of the, or the section stages of the League Cup. So, Robert, your memories of the 66-67 season?
There are many and varied. I think everything, probably everything that could have been said and written about this particular season has been done, and especially so since, given the 50th anniversary was 3 years ago, there's been a lot of great books written, some by the Lions squad themselves and some by some of the noted Celtic historians. And I think last week, or in the previous podcast, we talked about the fact that the 65-66 season should have brought our first treble. Then this season, 66-67, definitely provided that first treble and so much more in addition. For me, I attended my first ever match at Parkhead that season. It may well have been the Clyde game in January, but the one I remember was about 3 weeks before Lisbon on a Wednesday night at home to Dundee United, and we were due to clinch the title and make it two in a row, if you like. And bear in mind that the last time we'd won two league titles in a row was in the season when the Battle of the Somme was still raging. So we hadn't done it for 50 years. So that game was against Dundee United. My dad took me along. We sat in the old stand on a very sunny May evening. And it didn't go according to script. And we lost 3-2 that night. Strangely, we'd lost the earlier fixture at Tannadice on Hogmanay by the same score. Good Dundee United team in those days, run by Gerry Kerr. And in that season, they had beaten Barcelona home and away in the old Fair Cities Cup. So that was a disappointing start to my lifetime of attending games at Celtic Park, but the silver lining of that defeat was that it set the scene for winning the league at Ibrox 3 days later, and win the league we did on a very muddy Ibrox pitch. And Jinky scored a memorable 25-yarder into the top corner, which, you know, there's good footage that still exists of that.
Yeah, we talked last week on the podcast about actually people's perception of attendances in the late 60s and early 70s as being huge because of some of the big Hampden games. But actually, they weren't as huge as people think. That Dundee United game that you talk about, Celtic lost 3-2, 3rd of May. There was 40,000 people at that game. The week before we did 30,000 people watches draw 0-0 with Aberdeen. So actually, getting back to the one of the common things that happened, if teams stutter over the finishing line, we drew 0-0 at home to Aberdeen and then lost 3-2 at home to Dundee United and then drew 2 each with Rangers to clinch a title, as you say. So, but there's, in going for our second title in a row and in the season where we win everything, there's 3 games in a row, 2 at home and 1 away, where we got two draws and 1 defeat out of 3 games when we're just wanting to get over the line. We started Saint in the League Cup group stages, and again, one of the things that people forget is league seasons started. I mean, they was mid-September. You know, 10th of September before we started the league campaign against Clyde in that season. We'd had the group stages of the League Cup starting in the middle of August. We had won away at Tynecastle, and then we'd had some comfortable victories over Clyde and St Mirren. But it was really, the League Cup group stages was a big thing that started off league campaigns back then.
Yeah, the one thing I would begin with saying, Harry, is that a lot of the recollections or things that I'm going to bring up in for the first few seasons of the 9 in a row are things that I recall my dad telling me in later life. And there's 2 games that I think we need to mention for the beginning of this season. The first one was a Glasgow Cup final where we beat Rangers 4-0 at Ibrox, which was an astounding result, you know, to go to Ibrox and any time I win 4-0 is truly momentous. And I don't think younger fans might appreciate just what an important trophy the Glasgow Cup was in those days, because we're talking about attendances and stuff. 76,000 people were at that game at Ibrox, a sort of curtain raiser to the season. And we won 4-0, Bobby Lennox getting a hat-trick. And then, I don't know if it was before or just shortly after it, we played Manchester United, the great Man United team of Best and Lon Charlton under Sir Matt Busby, and we beat them 4-1. And I always remember my dad saying that you know, that it was so obvious that something special was just around the corner, because we weren't just winning games, we were beating quality teams, but we were really giving them thrashings. and but we carried that into the League Cup, excuse me, and into the early league season, and into the European Cup campaign. So that in late summer, autumn 1966, we're certainly on a roll. And at one point, it looked as if we were, you know, we could have been through the whole season unbeaten because we were winning, we were beating everybody that was put in front of us.
I think that's right. What St. Anthony says, we'd had that tour of the United States and Bermuda after the end of the 65-66 season. We'd had some great results. I think we'd beaten Tottenham a couple of times. That win over Man U that St. Anthony just mentioned. And then we, you know, when the competitive business started, we won our first 8 league games straight. We won all 10 games in the League Cup that season. We won 3 games in the Glasgow Cup. We won our first 4 games in the European Cup against Zurich and Nantes. And we'd scored 100 goals before the end of November. So quite astonishing run of success. And, you know, in many cases, the margin of victory. You know, we beat Stirling Albion 7-3 at home. We beat St Johnstone 6-1. We took 8 off St Mirren in the League Cup. 6 off Thistle. There was some very big wins indeed. And, you know, the team was really firing, and similar to the previous season, I think Joe McBride was central to a lot of it, and he ended up with 37 goals in half a season. So he didn't play again after Christmas Eve.
Yeah, well, I'll put some context to a couple of things that both of you said there. As you say, 6th of August 1966, Celtic beat Manchester United 4-1. There were 60,000 people there at Celtic Park. The goals were scored by Lennox, Murdoch, McBride, and then there was an own goal by a Manchester United player. And Hurricane Celt's glorious start is the headline in the newspaper article covering that game. And then we had the League Cup group stages, or the section stages, where our group was Hearts, Clyde, St Mirren, where we won 2-0 at Tynecastle, 6-0 at home to Clyde, 8-2 to St Mirren, 3-0 against Hearts, 3-1 away at Shawfield, and 1-0 against St Mirren at Love Street. And from there we went on to thump Dunfermline 6-3 in the first home leg of the League Cup, and 3-1 away in that. One of the interesting things for me, you mentioned, Robert, the 7 goals that they scored against Stirling Albion in November. One of the interesting things for me is the games where Celtic score lots of goals, we do concede goals as well. We beat Hibs 5-3 at Easter Road, so we scored 5 and conceded 3. We beat Dunfermline 5-4 at East End Park, again, scoring 5 and conceding 4. We beat Partick Thistle 6-2, and then in the League Cup, we scored 8 against St Mirren, but concede 2. We score 6 against Dunfermline, but concede 3, so we beat them firm on 9-4 on aggregate. And again, your point, Robert, about Joe McBride. So the Celtic Wiki describes it as this: the foundations for this outstanding success had already been laid in the previous season. At the start of the 66-67 season, the final touches were put in place with the purchase of Joe McBride from Motherwell. Joe went on to have an outstanding goal-scoring run before knee trouble put pay to his further appearances at the turn of the year. This pushed Celtic into the transfer market again, and Jockstein identified Willie Wallace as the man who could take over from where McBride had left off and continue the goal-scoring progress that Celtic had made. So, Saint, that was quite a pivotal moment. Joe McBride's banging in the goals, picks up an injury, and we managed to pick up another goal-scorer in Willie Wallace.
Can I just go back there a wee second? There's a couple of games that are worth pointing out there. The Dunfermline game, run about November 66, is quite noticeable because we were 2-0 down and I think 3-1 and 4-2 down in the course of the game. And again, I'm talking about my dad's recollections here. In many ways, that was a game of the season for him because he reckoned that at given points in that game, we were going to lose. Dunfermline was a cracking team at the time. It wouldn't have been a disgrace to lose to Dunfermline at that point. But he says, I think Joe McBride got a penalty in the last minute and it was such a dramatic game coming for 2-0 down, 3-1 down, 4-2 down, two goals at each period and pulling it back. So that was an indication of the spirit of the team as well. Not only did they play good football, but they certainly had the old Celtic fighting spirit in them. You were talking there about a lot of goals, Harry, and as much as that this was still an attacking era where teams attacked. It was only in the 70s, really, that the more defensive outlook on the game came in and teams began to defend and goals sort of dropped a wee bit. But getting back to what you were saying there about Willie Wallace, it was a masterstroke by Jock Stein because I'm led to understand from what I've read that Rangers were interested in Willie Wallace as well. And Steen waited till Rangers were playing, I think they were away playing a team in Germany, maybe. But they were abroad, and Steen stepped in and did the deal with Hearts for Willie Wallace while Rangers were away. And this was another example of one-upmanship, of Jock Steen being a step in front of Rangers in every aspect. And Celtic fans were delighted. But the interesting thing is that people think that Wallace was a replacement for Joe McBride. In later years, Big Jock alluded to the fact that the plan was to play McBride and Wallace together. And I think they only played together twice before Joe got the injury. But it shows you what a bit of good luck it was that with Joe being injured, Willie Wallace was there to sort of step into his shoes. And you still had Chalmers and you still had Lennox and you still had Jimmy Johnson in the forward line as well. So things worked out really well.
And I think Willie Wallace, you know, he was 26 years old. He was a Scottish international player. He had scored over 100 goals for Hearts before he moved to us. So he was a complete player, and he was more than a goal scorer. I think, you know, Willie Wallace was a great footballer. There was a number of times during this season when Bobby Murdoch was injured and Willie Wallace played right half, and he was quite adept as a midfield player as well. But, you know, similar to the Joe McBride signing, you know, truly inspired, you know, by Steen. And, you know, in less than 5 years with the club, Willie Wallace, I think, got about 140 goals, which was a fantastic return for what was, I think, £30,000. I think we broke our transfer record to buy Willie Wallace, and it was no more than £30,000, but fantastic piece of business for the club. My other recollection of the Dunfermline game, which St Anthony just mentioned, is, I mean, both my parents were from Fife, and, you know, I've got numerous relatives there, and I was actually in Fife on the day of that game in the Weems in central Fife, and I think a couple of the cousins had gone off to East End Park for the game, and I remember following the scoring on the radio, and we were 4-2 down with about 25 minutes to go. And two or three years ago, I had the good fortune to meet Bertie Auld, and we talked about that game. And his recall of that match was, you know, he spoke with great clarity about that being one of the great games of the season. You know, gave the players so much belief that they could come back three times from two goals down. I mean, not in some ways not too dissimilar from the game at Motherwell in the Invincible season when Rogic scored the winner. We won 4-3 and we'd been a couple of goals down twice in that game as well.
And these are all the types of things that make people winners and make titles. And you also talked there, saying about Jock Stein's influence over the whole of Scottish football, and Robert, that's part of what made Celtic winners, is that Jock Stein was such a massive presence over everything.
I think he you know, I think Jockstein freshened up everything on arrival. You know, he had been a great thinker about the game. A lot of when he was running Celtic reserves, everybody was impressed by, you know, his knowledge, his ideas. You know, he put them into practice at Dunfermline and Hibs. He had some success, and you know, it really was a breath of fresh air. But I think, you know, Steen also surrounded himself with good players or good staff that he had played with, and you have to admire the impact that people like Sean Fallon and Bob Rooney and Neely Mochen and Willie Fernie all had. So he assembled a team, and it was, you know, it was spectacular how quickly the success was gained.
So one of the key things, obviously, of the 66-67 season is that we win every trophy. So the first trophy we win is on the 29th of October 1966, when Celtic win the League Cup for only the fourth time in the club's history. Bobby Lennox scored with a spectacular volley. One of the things that's unique about that game is that Stevie Chalmers is the first Celtic player to appear as a substitute in a cup final. A match was attended by a delegation from Nantes, who Celtic would meet in the next round of the European Cup. Getting back to one of the things we talked about in the last podcast about young players coming through, the night before, Celtic reserves had lost in a reserve league match 3-0 to Stirling Albion. The Celtic team in the reserve match the night before was Martin, Young, Brogan, Henderson, Craig, Katanach, Taggart, Connolly, Quinn, Taylor and McCarry. They defeated Stirling Albion 3-0, and the Celtic scorers were Taylor, Quinn and Taggart. But obviously McCarry and Connolly, Brogan being key players that were in that game. So Celtic, so again from the Celtic wiki, Celtic complete the first part of the historic 66-67 all-conquering campaign with a narrow win over Rangers in the League Cup. Hampden saw Celtic beat Rangers in a tight game. Celtic had been odds-on favourites to win the game before kick-off. Celtic's goal was fit to win the final. Auld floated the ball to the back post and McBride nodded it back towards goal, where Lennox ran full pelt to blast the ball home without breaking stride. Celtic didn't find it easy against the Rangers side that fought doggedly. Hughes was injured at the start of the second half and was subbed by Chalmers to make him the first substitute in a cup final. It was a long second half for Celtic as they faced the Rangers onslaught, but the defence and keeper Simpson were outstanding on that day. Willie O'Neill was Celtic's hero late on with a vital goal line clearance when Simpson was beaten. Rangers played well, but Celtic proved they now had the resolve to withhold heavy pressure and come out on top. The Celtic team that day, relevant obviously because we all know the 67 team off the top of our head, was Simpson, Gemmell, O'Neill, Murdoch, McNeill, Clark, Johnson, Lennox, McBride, Auld and Hughes, with Chalmers coming on and Lennox scoring after 19 minutes.
Harry, there's an interesting wee story about that League Cup final which a few Celtic historians have put in books through the years, which I think it's a great wee story. Before the game, Rangers fans let balloons off, and the balloons were blown for the Rangers end towards the Celtic end, and one of them was just about to go into the Celtic net, and a wee boy jumped out the Celtic end and ran in and kicked a balloon round the post, and a huge roar went up for the Celtic end. Just a good laugh. It was just a wee bit of fun. But the irony is that with just a couple of minutes to go, Willie O'Neill cleared the ball off the line in the exact same spot as that wee boy kicked a balloon. And I always think that that's an interesting sort of wee anecdote from that game.
So, Robert, just a short while after that, so as I say, Celtic win the League Cup on the 29th of October. And then one of the things that we talk about is how many trophies Celtic won that season. And it was only three games later that Celtic won the Glasgow Cup. Now, for younger listeners, That's going to be very odd that that's listed in the pantheon of trophies that Celtic won that season as an important trophy. But actually, at that time, the Glasgow Cup mattered, and Celtic won the Glasgow Cup. It was a Monday night, 7th of November, against Partick Thistle. So, was the Glasgow Cup really important back then?
Well, it definitely was. I mean, it wasn't always an Old Firm final, but, you know, St Anthony's already mentioned the crowd at Ibrox in the game in August when we won 4-0. So 76,000, an incredible crowd, and that, you know, clearly states the importance of the trophy. And I think it was important for a number of years after that, and maybe, you know, towards the late 70s, early 80s, the Glasgow Cup became diminished and eventually became, you know, a tournament where youth players were played. But certainly it was important from a momentum point of view to win another trophy, to beat Rangers 4-0. We played a very, very strong side in all three games, including the final against the Jags. So I think at that time we just wanted to win every game, and more often than not we were just beating any opposition at all, whether it was Europe or domestic.
So, Stephen, the League Cup final against Partick Thistle, the Celtic team that day was Simpson, Gemmell, O'Neill, Murdoch, McNeil, Clark, Chalmers, Gallagher, McBride, Lennox, Auld, with a substitute of Brogan, and Celtic won 4-0. There's one interesting person missing from that lineup, and that was Jimmy Johnson.
Yeah, I think judging by the team that you've read out there, I think that's one of the first examples of maybe a manager using a rotation policy with squad. I think Jock would have had, if it's November 66, he'd probably been in the middle of the nonce fixtures and just won the League Cup. So he may be keen to give guys a rest and also keen to keep guys sharp that he might need to bring in. You mentioned Charlie Gallagher there, who played periodically through the season but never really held in a first-team spot. And Jim Brogan's a substitute as well. Jim's another guy. It would be a few years before Jim broke into the team. So, yeah, I think Jock, being quite astute, he would have known which players might have needed a wee rest and which players might have needed an opportunity to keep their sharpness.
Interestingly, that was a Monday night, Monday the 7th of November, that Celtic beat Partick Thistle. They had played against St Mirren on Saturday the 5th of November, so just 2 days earlier they had played St Mirren. And in the Celtic View, after the Glasgow Cup final, Jock Stein had said that the players that thought they knew better than the people that set out the plans and put the tactics in place, the players who thought they knew better than the people who set out the plans and put the tactics for the game in place. And he promised to come down hard on offenders in the future. Players were meant to do what they were told and not what they wanted. So obviously he wasn't happy that 2 days earlier Celtic had drawn at home to St Mirren at Celtic Park in the league in front of 21,000 people, and had been very critical in the Celtic View about that performance, and you know, the team changed a wee bit for the victory over Thistle, the 4-0 victory, and obviously people were getting put in their place. So that was getting through to the point where the league, the Scottish Cup and the European Cup were going to be the focus, to give people some context of the league campaign at that time. The league, the 18-team first division, was Celtic, Rangers, Clyde, Aberdeen, Hibs, Dundee, Kilmarnock, Dunfermline, Dundee United, Motherwell, Hearts, Partick Thistle, Airdrie, Falkirk, St Johnson, Stirling Albion, St Mirren and Ayr United. So some, again, you can see a common theme of the teams that are in the top flight. So onto the and again, to give some more context to it, the Scottish teams playing in Europe were Celtic, Rangers, Dundee United, Dunfermline and Kilmarnock. Dundee United that season, they knocked Barcelona out of the Fairs Cup in the first round, and then got knocked out by Juventus. Dunfermline knocked out Frigg Oz of Oslo, the Norwegian team, out of the Fairs Cup, but then get knocked out in the next round by Dynamo Zagreb on away goals. Kilmarnock, they got past Royal Antwerp, then another Belgian team in Ghent, then the East German Lokomotiv Leipzig, they got past them, and then lost to Leeds United in the Fairs Cup semi-final. And the other Glasgow team, Rangers, they defeated Glentoran, then Borussia Dortmund, then Real Zaragoza, then Slavia Sofia, and then we'll get on to their playing in the European Cup Winners' Cup European Cup Winners' Cup final. Robert, do you have any memory of the other Scottish teams playing in European competition that season?
Well, I do. It's just worth mentioning that, you know, Dunfermline lost, as you say, to Dynamo Zagreb on the away goals rule. And, I mean, Dynamo Zagreb won the tournament. They beat Leeds in the final. So Dunfermline came pretty close to going further in the tournament. I remember that the Kilmarnock-Leeds semi-final was the same night as Lisbon. If you remember,
right,
the Lisbon kickoff was something like 5:15 in the afternoon, and I think later that evening Kilmarnock were up against Leeds in the second leg, and they needed to win. They needed to beat Leeds 2-0 to go through to the final, and I think it was a 0-0 draw, and they didn't make it. I mean, I think Rangers did very well to get to the final. They were up against Bayern Munich. It was effectively a home game for Bayern Munich because the final was in Nuremberg, and this was a Bayern Munich team with a young Beckenbauer, Gerd Müller, Meyer, but I think Rangers lost in extra time that night. So again, it re-emphasises how strong the Scottish First Division was in those days, and you know, the teams that we were playing in Europe, maybe Zurich, maybe Nantes, maybe they weren't as strong as a Rangers or, you know, not much different from a Dunfermline or a Kilmarnock, you know, who were doing so well in Europe that season.
So on to our European campaign. So who wants to be first to talk through some of these results? Saint, we'll start with... We had FC Zurich in the first round of the European Cup. It was a 2-0 victory at home and a 3-0 victory away. So pretty comfortable in the first round of the European Cup.
I think from what I've read in those games, another example of Jock Stein's football and brain, if you like. We won the first leg 2-0 at Celtic Park, and some of the players were a wee bit apprehensive about going to Zurich because Zurich would be at home with a crowd behind them, and the feeling was that they would go for broke and attack Celtic. And Jock Stein said, no, this team haven't got, they can't play like that. They're a very methodical team. They will play the same way. Celtic Park, they'll play the same way at home as what they did at Celtic Park. And a few of the players were a wee bit sort of doubtful that this was the case. And it turned out to be exactly the case. Zurich played the same tactics and Celtic beat them 3-0. So I think for a position of trust, if there was any doubt in the players' minds that Jockstein didn't know his stuff, then after that, those first two games in Europe, they knew right away that they were dealing with a guy who was as sharp as a tack when it came to reading teams and tactical knowledge.
Did you manage to get to any of the European games, Robert?
Not that season, unfortunately. Zurich were the champions of Switzerland, Nantes were the champions of France. Both France and Switzerland had featured at the 1966 World Cup in England just a few months earlier, at a time when the World Cup was only 16 teams and there was only 8 or 9 qualifiers from Europe. So the state of French and Swiss football was pretty high at that time. And, you know, similarly, you know, when we got drawn against Vojvodina, you know, maybe most people in Scotland hadn't heard of Vojvodina from, you know, what is now Serbia. But, you know, the previous season, the Yugoslav champions Partizan Belgrade had reached the final of the European Cup, lost to Real Madrid. And in 1968, the Yugoslav national team reached the final of the European Championships and lost to Italy after a replay. So Yugoslav football was at a very, very high status at that time. And then if you look at Dukla Prague, the army team from the Czechoslovakia at that time, you know, they had knocked out Ajax in the quarterfinals. Ajax had taken 7 off Liverpool in the second round. And so clearly, you know, Dukla, you know, were a very strong, experienced team as well. So, you know, sometimes the landscape changes in Europe and countries go through periods of relative strength or relative weakness. But, you know, there's no doubt the four teams we played and beat in order to reach Lisbon, you know, had some considerable pedigree.
So Celtic had seen Celtic had 1-2-0 at Celtic Park, beaten Zurich 3-0. They'd beaten Nantes 3-1 away, and then won 3-1 at home against Nantes. Vojvodina was the first one where there was a bit of a challenge because they lost 1-0 away in Yugoslavia, and then had to. This is the one where got more TV footage of it, and it's a bit more famous on the Vojvodina. And then, as Robert says, Dukla Prague had some great results. We won 3-1 at Celtic Park, and then went over there and got the 0-0. So. That was when it was starting to become more challenging, the Vojvodina and Dukla Prague games.
Well, the Vojvodina game has became the stuff of legend because, in my young days, when I was listening to stories about people talking about games, I love to hear the story about the Vojvodina game at Celtic Park. In the first leg, I think Celtic had been surprised by how physical and how strong the Yugoslavs were. I think we were happy to get back to Celtic Park with just a 1-goal deficit. And for a long time at Celtic Park, it looked as if Vojvodina were going to be strong enough to stop us scoring and maybe prevail on the night. So when Stevie Chalmers scored the equaliser, there was a wee bit of relief. And as the game wore on, I think in those days, there was going to be a third game, I think, in Rotterdam, from memory. Definitely a third game. It might not have been Rotterdam. But people, by all accounts, at Celtic Park were actually discussing, where's the third game? You know, the time's running out. And I don't think there's ever been a more dramatic ending to any game at Celtic Park than that Vojvodina game. Because, so much rested on that, and the Charlie Gallagher's floated corner, Big Billy attacked it. The goalkeeper was a bit hesitant. I think he came off his line and then stopped. So he was out his goal, and Billy's header went right over the goalkeeper and into the net. And by all accounts, for anybody that was there, I don't think it's hard to think of celebrations so similar in such an important game. The place just went mad, and I think there was a realisation at that point that they were into the semi-finals and that anything was now possible.
And I think there's a very dramatic photograph, which is quite a famous photograph, of Billy's goal in the last minute from behind the goal. And there's a guy flying through the air with his arm up trying to stop the header, but it's not the goalie. So the goalie had come off his line and, you know, he was in no man's land, and it was one of the defenders trying to save it on the line. Yeah, people of my dad's cohort said it was the greatest night they've ever known at Parkhead, bar none, which is quite a statement. And just one further comment about the Nantes game away, which I should have mentioned earlier. I mean, this was one of Jimmy Johnson's great games, and in what was a terrific season for him. And that was when he was christened the Flying Flea by the French press. You know, he turned on a mesmerising performance in what looked like a difficult first leg fixture away in France, but, you know, we won both legs quite comfortably. There was something I wanted to say about the lead-up to the Vojvodina game, and I'm kind of indebted to the Celtic historian David Potter, had written about this in his book called I Remember 1967. So when the draw was made that we would be playing Vojvodina, Jock Steen quite quickly arranged a friendly match against Dynamo Zagreb at Parkhead, and 46,000 turned up in February, and Jock said he was going to play an experimental tactics, and it certainly was. John Hughes had number 5 on his shots, Billy McNeil number 3, Tommy Gemmell was number 8, and it was very strange tactics. We ended up losing the game 1-0 after missing a barrel load of chances, but I think Jock wanted to get the experience of playing against Yugoslav team before we took on Vojvodina, and I think he knew a lot of the Yugoslav press would come to Parkhead for this Zagreb game, and maybe he wanted to mislead them in many ways. I think what he didn't realise was how much help was offered by Dynamo Zagreb about how to beat Vojvodina and highlighting all their weaknesses. And I suppose all of our knowledge of Balkan politics wasn't that great in 1967, but, you know, there was a fierce rivalry between Zagreb as a Croatian club and the Serbian clubs like Vojvodina. So let me just read out the team for you for that Zagreb game. This is how the team was laid out: Simpson, Katanach, McNeil, Clark, Hughes, Murdoch, Auld, Gemmell, Wallace, Chalmers, Lennox. So it could have been a 3-4-3. I think in David Porter's book, he described it as a 3-2-2-3, which in these days, you sometimes get these kind of odd combinations. But for 1967, this was revolutionary.
Which actually, you know, fast forward, and that's also one of the tales from the final itself, where when the players were training, and Jock Steen knew that Inter Milan were going to be sending people along to watch Celtic train, he also had the players playing all over the place in different positions with different numbered shots on to confuse the Inter Milan, because it's the days before television, so it's not like people are going to go, no, I recognise that, that's Auld, and he doesn't play there. You know, they don't have that, they couldn't go on YouTube and download every single game, or Y-Scout or whatever, and download every game that Celtic were playing. So these types of things actually mattered back then.
Very true. I mean, another example of that, not long before Lisbon, was the Scottish Cup final. We haven't really got onto the Scottish Cup yet, but when we beat Aberdeen in the final, Jimmy Johnson played centre forward that day. And I think Wallace, who scored the goals, or Chalmers played out wide on the right, and Jinky played through the middle. Still had number 7 on his shots, but again, I think Jockstein trying to, you know, maybe play some mind games with Harara ahead of the final.
Well, I was going to, since we've done the run up, the Scottish Cup final wasn't the big last game of the season game that we now are used to. So the Scottish Cup final actually took place on the 29th of April in 1967. So it took place just a couple of days after Celtic had gone to Prague and drawn 0-0. So quite a difficult one for the players to do. But one of the things, Saint, that I notice is our whole Scottish Cup run that season was in Glasgow. We beat Arbroath 4-0 on the 28th of January. We beat Elgin, who would have been a Highland League club at the time. We beat Elgin 7-0. We beat Queen's Park 5-3. We drew with Clyde 0-0 in the Cup semi-final at Hampden in front of 56,500 people. We then, 4 days later, played Clyde again in the replay and won 2-0 on the 5th of April before the Cup final against Aberdeen. So do you think having those games, that run of games at Celtic in Glasgow, assisted Celtic in that period? Because obviously travelling was much more laborious back then.
I don't think it would have done us any harm, in as much as you say there, that you're playing it in your home city, even though it's not necessarily home games. And, you know, traditionally, Pittodrie, Easter Road, Tynecastle are difficult places to go to. So if you can avoid them, it's always to be welcomed. There's a couple of the cup ties I think are worth noting. The first one, I think, was against Arbroath. And that was the famous day that Berwick beat Rangers 1-0 at Shields Field Park. And it was noticeable at this time that Rangers were beginning to implode, that Steen's new Celtic were too much for them, that the pressure was maybe building on them. And that was a, you know, that would be a humiliation for any Rangers team, but particularly at that time. And also screwed Rangers up in as much as two good players that they had at the time, Jim Forrest and George McLean, never played for the club again. They were made scapegoats, which was probably unfair because, you know, you play as a team, you lose as a team. But those two guys were out the door. Now, Forrest especially was a fantastic striker by all accounts, and there was a lot of Celtic fans that were quite happy to see him move on to elsewhere. The other game I'd like to mention is the Clyde semi-final that finished nothing each in the first game, because by all accounts, that was one of the hardest games that Celtic had that season. If you did the contemporary reports from that game, Clyde were unlucky not to win. They had several good chances and Celtic had a bit of an off day. It was quite a windy day by all accounts, and it made for difficult to play in. And, you know, that's one game in the course of the season that few people remember. But we were quite fortunate probably to come through that and win the replay. And the last thing to say is, you were talking there about how the cup final wasn't the sort of prestige game that we have now. It's the end of season showpiece game. The other thing to bear in mind here is that in those days, that league games were played in the same day as a cup final. So, it wasn't live on TV, and all these other league games were taking place in the same day, which I think is, looking back now, it is absolutely crazy stuff.
So, Robert, do you have any recollections of that Scottish Cup run that took place in Glasgow? 31,000 watched us play Arbroath, 34,000 watched us defeat Elgin, 34,000 watched us defeat Queen's Park. In the two games against Clyde, it was a combined 110,000 people, 111,000 people, and then 127,000 people watched us beat Aberdeen 2-0 in the Scottish Cup final. Do you have any recollections of that Scottish Cup run?
I do. But I also remember the Berwick game quite vividly. And, you know, no Celtic fan of the time would ever forget the name of their goal scorer that day, which was Sammy Reid, or the fact that Berwick's inspired goalkeeper that day was none other than Jock Wallace. And there was a quote in the guy in the Glasgow Herald wrote on the Monday after the Berwick game. He says, "Never in the history of Scottish football has there been a result to match this one. And because Rangers are Rangers, it will inevitably lead to serious repercussions." And we mentioned earlier, Rangers lost the Cup Winners' Cup final. And, you know, who knows if they hadn't discarded Jim Forrest and George McLean, who were two good players, you know, they may well have prevailed in Nuremberg. I remember well the quarter-final against Queen's Park at Parkhead. And a friend of mine in Glasgow, Alan Hopper, his dad played for Queen's Park and in fact, scored two goals in that 5-3 game. And according to the match report, Hopper gave Big Billy and John Clark a very uncomfortable afternoon. He was the only opposition player to score against Celtic in the Scottish Cup that season because the other Queen's Park goal in that game was a Tommy Gemmell own goal in 27 seconds. So I've never seen the footage of that, but that would be quite interesting to score an own goal that quickly. And that Queen's Park match is also famous for the fact that Sean Connery appeared at the game and took a lot of photographs with the team, and it was just prior to the release of the fifth James Bond movie, You Only Live Twice, which you mentioned earlier, Harry. And I remember the final. I wasn't at the final. I remember listening to the radio and David Francis' commentary and the Willie Wallace goals and. Yeah, it was just another leg in the five trophy haul for the season, and as you said, apart from the Clyde game, it was pretty straightforward.
I think the other thing that's important that we need to note here is the team began to evolve through the course of the season, and up until New Year, it was pretty stable, and then obviously Willie Wallace arrived and Joe McBride got injured. But there's something that I've always found of interest in that Willie and Neil played almost every game up until the defeat at Tannadice and Hogmanay. And into New Year, Jock Steen changed the fullbacks. Up to that point, it had been Tommy Gemmell at right-back and Willie Neil at left-back. And then Steen changed things and brought in Jim Craig at right-back and moved Tommy to left-back, of which they were to become famous at Lisbon, of course, for playing in those roles. Now, I don't really, probably Robert might know better than me, but I don't really know if Willie O'Neill was dropped for tactical reasons or he had an injury or anything like that, but I just think that's one of the noticeable things, that the team was fairly settled, but that is the only position of debate that you can say that, you know, that there's a bit of conjecture as to why Willie O'Neill would be left out and Jim Craig would be brought in.
I think from what I've read, you know, Craig was younger, more athletic, a bit more attack-minded. But, you know, Willie O'Neill made a massive contribution to the season. He played over 30 matches in all competitions. Obviously played in the League Cup final win, the Glasgow Cup final win. You know, and he's one of these ones that, you know, very much part of the Lisbon Lions squad, but like Joe McBride, like John Hughes, you know, didn't feature on the big day in Lisbon. And, you know, I think justifiably they would have some mixed feelings about that. I think statistically the defence improved in the second half of the season. You know, we were still scoring a lot of goals, but we certainly conceded a lot less. And the swashbuckling style of football that we were playing, you know, I don't think Jock was really too bothered if we were winning 8-2 or 7-3 and we were conceding a few goals. But, you know, it's worth noting that in the European run, we conceded very few goals indeed. So I think when we had to defend, we showed that we could defend. And whether Jim Craig was a better defender than Willie O'Neill, I really could not comment on at all. I think John Hughes deserves a mention. You know, we We know it was a personal tragedy for Joe McBride not to get his fitness back in time for Lisbon, based on all the goals he'd scored up until Christmas. But for Big Yogi as well, you know, he had made his contributions during the season. You know, he'd arguably, you know, along with Big Billy, who was maybe one of the biggest stars in the team when Jockstein arrived in 1965. And, you know, perhaps this season was a bit of a frustration for John Hughes that he didn't play as many games as he would have liked, didn't score as many goals. And I think there was some debate as to whether John Hughes was dropped for Lisbon or whether he was injured. But I read his autobiography some years back, and he made it quite clear that, you know, he was injured. He had gotten injured in that Scottish Cup semi-final against Clyde in the first match. And there's no way he could have played in Lisbon. But, you know, for me, Big Yogi's a real legend. And when I was a kid, you know, Wee Jinky was magical with all his tricks and movement. But the sight of John Hughes charging down the left wing, riding tackle after tackle, you know, his shooting prowess with either foot, you know, a true legend. And I think he's the seventh or eighth highest scorer in Celtic's history, which is sometimes forgotten.
Well, it's interesting you mentioned that Clyde game, and also your Willie O'Neill comment saying, so the Clyde game, the first game that finished in a draw, was Simpson, Craig, Gemmell, Wallace, McNeil, Clark, Johnson, All, Chalmers, Lennox and Hughes, with Gallagher as a substitute. And then the replay against Clyde, Simpson, Craig, Gemmell, Wallace, McNeil, Clark, Johnson, and then Hughes went off as a substitute. Gallagher, Chalmers, Lennox, Auld. So you can see that he got injured in that Cup semi-final replay. But the other thing about Willie O'Neill saying on the comments, he signed for Celtic in 1959 and made his debut in the 1961 Scottish Cup final replay against Dunfermline. But he made a total of 55 Celtic appearances, of which 32 of them were in the 66-67 season. So the bulk of his Celtic games were in the European Cup winning season. But apparently that was in part because Jim Craig was doing quite a bit of his dentistry university studies at that time. Mm-hmm. And also Jim Craig comments that Willie O'Neill was much more of a defensive fullback than he was. So in terms of his style of play, but Celtic signed Willie O'Neill from St Anthony's Football Club.
The famous St Anthony's in Govan, that's right. Willie was the last guy who... St Anthony's had a long, rich history of providing Celtic with good players, guys like Bobby Evans, very particular... Who St Anthony's would have been a great nursery team for Celtic and other senior clubs in those days, where junior football was very, very strong. There's one wee interesting anecdote I'd like to share with you. We're talking about there about John Hughes being injured, and he must have been very, very disappointed to miss out on the big day in Lisbon. I'm going back about 30 years, and I was a night out one night whereby Bobby Murdoch and John Hughes were there, and John Hughes was very, he regretted very much the fact that he declared the injury to Jockstein, because I think John thought he could have played in the final if he had to, but Jock obviously didn't want to take any chances and he wanted players who were fit. So John's my abiding memory of John Hughes was that he regretted owning up to the injury and not making it clear that he was fitter than Jock thought he was. In contrast to that, Bobby Murdoch had picked up quite a serious ankle injury before Lisbon, but didn't really declare it to Jockstein. He sort of managed to keep Jock unawares. So when Bobby played in Lisbon, in his own words, he was only maybe about 70% fit, and he had to play a lot of the game kicking the ball with his left foot rather than his right foot. because hitting it with the right foot was causing quite a bit of discomfort. So, and that's something that in later years that Bobby put down in print. So it's interesting to note how you've got the two contrasts there. You've got John Hughes declares the injury, doesn't get to play, but Bobby Murdoch hides it or shields it a wee bit better, and he gets to play in Lisbon.
And what a game he had as well, even with just playing with his left foot.
Well, so we're going to talk about the game. So 29th of October, Celtic have secured the League Cup. Celtic have secured the Glasgow Cup. 29th of April, Celtic have secured the league, the Scottish Cup. And then 2-2 draw, 6th of May, Ibrox, Celtic secure the league. And that sets us up for the 25th of May, 1967, Celtic against Inter Milan. So, who wants to kick off talking about that game?
I'll go first because I think Robert's got better memories than me, obviously, because he remembers it better. I was only one at the time. I asked my dad in later years, why didn't he go to Lisbon? And he said, what year was it? And I said, 67. He says, when were you born? I said, 66. He says, well, work it out for yourself. So I think I cost my dad the opportunity to go at the final. The only thing I would say about Lisbon is that I've been watching the footage countless times, you know, through in Celtic films through the years, and then as video come in and DVD come in, there's no Celtic fan as they watched it dozens of times. Never fail to be impressed by the style and the manner in which they won, because the attacking football that day was a joy to behold. And I think we didn't just do Scottish football a service, but I think we did football in general a service by taking on such a dour and defensive formation that the Inter Milan had in those days with the Catenaccio. And we didn't just beat them, we smashed them to pieces. And it's just such a wonderful, wonderful memory for everybody concerned.
That's right. I think, as has been commented many, many times over the years, if you looked out on the streets in Glasgow, and we stayed down in Park Road at that time, just Woodlands Road. The streets were empty as kick-off time approached. I'm not even sure if people were in pubs watching it or not. It was certainly live on the telly. And, you know, we definitely just had a black and white telly in those days. But, yeah, we sat and watched it as a family. And, yeah, it was amazing. A team with relatively little European experience could take on a team like Inter, who had won the trophy twice in the previous 3 years, from being behind early in the match. I mean, it was just everything you wanted it to be, the style. It was unappreciated by people right across the football world that, you know, the Italians with their Catenaccio had been defeated by a brilliant attacking display. There was a book I read many years ago by Ian Archer, who used to write for the Herald. He used to be on Scotsport quite a lot. And he writes this book about Lisbon and some of the other European away games of that era. And there's a quote from a Portuguese immigration officer or customs officer the day after the final, where he says, every time I open a cupboard, a Celtic fan falls out. And, you know, you have to remember that in those days, travel was not, you know, easy. And, of course, the numbers vary. You know, did we take 15,000 or 25,000 to Lisbon? Whatever the number was, it was an extraordinary number by, you know, 1967's standards. There was the famous motorcade that left Glasgow. I think a number of cars didn't make it all the way to Lisbon. So it was an adventure, an amazing experience. Apparently some guys, you know, one of the flights turned up late and, you know, the plane was still taxiing on the runway and fans had opened the doors and they were already sort of jumping out of a moving plane, you know, to try and get there in time for kickoff. So the stories are legend, and yeah, we'd love that experience again. And we, you know, we nearly got there with Seville in 2003, where we took 80,000 fans, and you know, came so close to a second European trophy. But the manner in which we won it is something that hasn't really been repeated by other teams since then.
So, and I'm lifting this from the Celtic Wiki. There's some interesting things, some trivia that we know about. Obviously, Celtic became the first British, Northern European, and non-Latin side to win the European Cup. The only Scottish club to have ever won the European Cup. In fact, the only Scottish club to have ever reached the final. Celtic completed a clean sweep of all five competitions they entered: League Cup, Scottish Cup, Glasgow Cup, and European Cup. Inter Milan were favourites. And my previous winners of the tournament, they had lost only once in the European Cup in four successive seasons, winning the trophy twice and losing that sole game to Real Madrid. So it gives some context to what Celtic were up against. But on the day, Celtic had 42 attempts on goal, Inter Milan had 5. Celtic had 10 corners, Inter Milan had 0. It's one of these things that when you watch it back, Celtic destroyed Inter Milan that day. 42 attempts on goal, 10 corners. It was.
Yeah, I think Sarti, the Inter goalie, I don't know what the stats were for shots on targets or the amount of shots that he saved, but he had many great saves, and you know, we hit the woodwork a couple of times, so it really could have been a more comprehensive victory. But you know, we'll take 2-1, and I think, you know, to win it late on was, you know, was just part of the glory of the occasion. And the other great photograph of Steen and Fallon and Mochen leaping off the bench, John Fallon, who was the substitute that day, all leaping off the bench at the final whistle, was quite an iconic photograph in our history.
Game was played on a Thursday. Celtic began their lead-up to the game the week before, immediately after their last Scottish League game against Kilmarnock. Spent most of the time in Scotland after the last league game down at Seamill. Back in 1979-80-81, I lived down in West Kilbride. Celtic still used to go to the Seamill Hydro then. You could meet the players. Quite a change in player prep now. Jock Steen, the master tactician, closeted the players in schemes and tactics, so not only were they physically fit and prepared, but they were also mentally sharp and ready. A report appeared in the Evening Times saying that the new Chicago football team were trying to entice Bobby Murdoch, Willie Wallace and Bobby Lennox to the USA, with salaries around £20,000 a year being offered, which would have been enormous. All three had re-signed for Celtic for the new season. The story was thought to be a ringer. So the Celtic party, getting back to the O'Neill conversation we just had, the Celtic party that left for Lisbon on Tuesday, 23rd of May, from Glasgow Airport, as well as the side, which we all know and we'll get onto in a second, it included Fallon, Young, Katanak, Cushley, McBride, who was recovering from his knee injury, Hughes, Brogan, O'Neill and Charlie Gallagher. Interestingly, saying we were talking about the substitutes. Interesting, because you've done a podcast with the man. Obviously, the team for the day was Simpson, Craig, Gemmell, Murdoch, McNeil, Clark, Johnson, Wallace, Chalmers, Old, Lennox. But he stuck a goalkeeper on as a substitute on the bench that day. Now, you've done the podcast with John Fallon. So, what was he thinking behind having a substitute goalkeeper that day when the teams we've gone through, he'd never had a substitute goalkeeper before?
My understanding is that when you go to the final, you were only allowed a goalkeeper on the bench because it was a specialised position. So if your goalkeeper got injured, for example, and somebody had to get in goal, it would weaken the team so much it wouldn't make for a good game, a good spectacle. So I don't think it was a case of Jockstein choosing Fallon. I think it was a case of you had to choose a goalkeeper. I would need to look into that further, but I'm almost certain that's the case. And Inter Milan, I think, would have been the same. They would have had a substitute goalkeeper on the bench as well. Interestingly, John's quite a a fascinating character in many ways. And his experience was that before the game, he was told to go. And Jock Stein wanted the bench nearest the dressing room, which Celtic had been allocated, but Inter Milan had tried to commandeer it beforehand. And I think John had to go with a bit of physical presence and a bit of threat to make it clear that Celtic were getting that bench. And the other thing as well is quite sad to say that he never got his medal. He was due a medal. And there was a wee bit of debate through the years what happened. I think Robert Kelly, let me get this right, I think Jock Stein took it off him and gave it to Robert Kelly as a present to the chairman, which is a very unusual thing to do and quite a cruel thing as well, to be honest, because John, although he didn't play, he'd earned a medal by being named in the team. So happy to say that many, many years later, I think Celtic did get John Fallon a medal, and hopefully that would have made up for not getting it on the day.
So there's going to be a separate podcast extra on top of this, which will just cover off the actual game. It's going to have some commentary from the game in various bits and pieces. So if people are wondering why it's not going to go into too much detail on the game, what's your specific memories of the game, Robert?
The goals and the end and the pitch invasion. And one of my dad's best friends, Brian Geraghty, he's on the pitch, and another iconic picture of Big Billy trying to get off the pitch, surrounded by fans. I think he's already lost his top. And my dad's friend is right next to him. And in the heat of Lisbon, he's wearing a suit, he's got a tie on, he's got a jacket on. It's very strange. It would not happen today.
No, well, that's one of the things. There were 20 charter flights left Glasgow Airport between 1:30 a.m. and 9:30 a.m. to make the 3 to 4 hour flight to Lisbon. And I've seen the documentaries before about, and you talked about the motorcade, Robert. For so many people, this was their first ever time abroad. So it's a big deal. So they were smart to go abroad. They were wearing their shirt and tie and suit because this was an important thing they were doing. They had to get passports specially to go. It was the days before the package holiday. And going abroad was exceptionally unusual. So was the whole of Scotland happy at this result, Robert?
Probably too young to appreciate that. I think a lot of the Rangers fans strongly believed that they were going to win in the Cup Winners' Cup final. And as I say, Kilmarnock were still in the semis of the UEFA Cup then. So, and Scotland had just beaten England at Wembley when England were world champions. So it was really, everything was going Scotland's way. And, you know, I think for many Rangers fans, there was, you know, they probably thought it was a great thing that Celtic had won the European Cup. And for many Rangers fans, they probably thought it was the worst thing that's ever happened to them in their life. So, you know, there would have been mixed views right across the spectrum.
The one thing that is unusual is that the Cup Winners' Cup game came after the European Cup. Whereas in later years, the European Cup is always the prestige game for UEFA, and was always the one that was held to the end to let the UEFA Cup final get played and the Cup Winners' Cup final. So I'm not really sure what the reason was for that, but I think that there's a contrast here between the two finals. Celtic go out in Lisbon, they play an attack formation, and they basically blitz Inter Milan. The whole of Europe is watching this, and they're very, very impressed. And you know, we blew away the Catenaccio defensive formation. But Rangers, due to the fact that they'd sold or they weren't playing Forrest and McLean, by all accounts, the Rangers team that played Bayern Munich that night had seven defenders in it, if you include the goalkeeper, and they were hamstrung because they didn't have any outlet up front. to score goals. Their capacity for scoring goals was very much reduced without those two players. So that, in essence, to cut their own throats. And I think Rangers fans were frustrated at the fashion in which they lost that final, because they put a fairly defensive line-up. There was a number of people that were playing out of position. And I think after Celtic's attacking spectacular performance in Lisbon, I think Rangers was a bit of a disappointment to their supporters, that they wanted to do something in that fashion, and yet they weren't allowed to do so.
So, Robert, after we win the European Cup, I mean, bring it back to Glasgow for the first time, there was one more game played by Celtic in what you might class as that season. And that was Celtic went to play Real Madrid. Now, we were invited to play in the Alfredo Di Stefano testimonial before we'd beaten Inter Milan. But with Real Madrid's success in the early part of the European Cup, they were still considered by many to be the best team in Europe. And they themselves considered themselves the real best team in Europe. So there was actually quite a lot of interest in this game. It wasn't your usual testimonial. Celtic, the current champions of Europe, against the self-styled champions of Europe in Real Madrid. And we went there and put on a masterclass and won.
Yes, I remember that. And Bobby Lennox got the goal, but it was... The game was memorable, I think, even for the Madrid fans, for the performance of wee Jimmy that night, who had a really superb game. And, you know, it's worth noting that Jimmy Johnson came third in the Ballon d'Or that season, what was then called the European Footballer of the Year Awards. And no Scottish, or no player from the Scottish League had ever even had a point in the previous votes. Jimmy Johnson got 39 votes. Bobby Charlton was second. And the award was won by Florian Albert from Ferencvaros, who must have been bloody good to beat Bobby Charlton and Jimmy Johnson that season. And Tommy Gemmell was sixth in the voting, just behind Beckenbauer and Eusebio. So there was recognition from right across Europe as to just how good Johnson and Gemmell and, you know, I suppose some of the others would have merited, you know, inclusion in that awards that season. And so I remember that well, the game in Madrid. It was a perfect way to bookend the season after having battered Manchester United at the beginning of the season. So...
So saying a party of 15 left Glasgow for that game. So what's your thoughts on it?
I'm always amazed at the risk that Jockstein took by playing that game, because if we'd have played in that game and the players weren't up for it and or were maybe in a holiday mode because they just won the European Cup, and we'd lost 2 or 3 nil, then people would have said, they won that European Cup before it because Real Madrid weren't in it. And that would have, you know, people would have held that against us in the years that followed. But I do think that by playing Real Madrid and beating them so convincingly, we may have won the European Cup in Lisbon, but we became the true champions of Europe when we beat Real Madrid in their own patch, because any doubt that anybody had that this was some sort of fluke or off, it was put to bed at that point, because you know Di Stefano in his testimonial game would have wanted to go out on a high. Real Madrid would have wanted to get these upstarts for Scotland and show them that they were still masters of Europe, that they were still the main team to contend with. And I'm absolutely, I don't think in the modern age any manager would accept that. I think Jockstein showed huge courage by playing that game and huge belief in his players. And legend has it that Steen left it to the players to decide, because I think he appreciated that they were knackered after such a hard season, and when the players heard that it was De Stefano, he was the Messi of his day. De Stefano, it would be like Messi having a testimonial now and asking Celtic to play. It was such a compliment, such an honour to be asked to play in that game, that every one of the players said yes, even though they were putting their reputations in the line, had they lost that game.
Well, De Stefano said, the Scotsman who gave me the most trouble was Bobby Lennox of Celtic. My testimony in the Bernabeu was against Celtic, of course, as they were the champions of Europe in 1967. And although I remember the Bernabeu rising to Jimmy Johnson, I admired Lennox greatly. Which is quite an interesting one. And your point there, the Celtic Wiki says that Jock wanted this game won as Real Madrid were still in power. And if they beat Celtic, they would argue that Celtic winning in Lisbon was just one of those flukes. Jock was also cute enough to change the team slightly with John Fallon and Willie O'Neill playing, so that if Real won, they couldn't say that they'd beaten the Lisbon Lions. Bertiold was sent off in the game. His version of events was that Jock Stein had told him to get a grip of Amancio and nullify him, as he was one of the who would control the play. He and Amancio went at it and both were sent off. Bertie admits that he was bricking it as he's going back to the dugout, having been sent off in a testimonial, and he could see that Jock Stein was fuming. And as he went into the dugout, so Bertie said, "Job done, boss." And even Big Jock started laughing. The Celtic team that night was Fallon, Craig, Gemmell, Clark, McNeil, O'Neill, Johnson, Murdoch, Wallace, Auld, Lennox, with four substitutes of Simpson, Chalmers, Gallagher and Catanach. I think probably in some ways that was possibly a suitable end to the season, actually, that not only did we win the European Cup and win all the domestic trophies, but we went across to Real Madrid in front of 120,000 people in the, you know, we beat Inter Milan in a neutral stadium. We went out to Madrid, played Madrid in their own ground when Madrid considered themselves champions of Europe. And although it's a testimonial, I'm sure they were up for it to prove that they were the best team in Europe. So probably fitting that the club should finish the season in that way. And famously, for the last 15 minutes of that game, nobody would go near Jimmy Johnson, who says it was the best game he ever had in a Celtic jersey. Any specific memory, final memory you'd like to say about that season before we move on to the following season, Robert?
I think a couple of, not memories, but just a couple of stats. And I kind of read on Wiki that the number of goals we scored that season in competitive matches was 196, and that is still a world record to this day. If it's in Wiki, it must be true. The other thing I thought was interesting is that the 11 that became the Lisbon Lions had only ever played together as an 11 on five occasions prior to Lisbon. And of those five games, we only won two of them. So we went into the most important game in our history with an 11 that didn't really have a big track record in the previous months because of the rotation policies that Big Jock employed. And so that's just another observation or fact to leave you with.
So the Six-Day War broke out at the time that we were playing Real Madrid, and we had a bit of a war ourselves in the World Club Championships, but we'll leave that because it took place during the 67-68 season, so we'll leave that our own Montevideo war in Montevideo for the following season's podcast. We've rounded off 66-67 season, the season where we won everything, And there'll be a short podcast to follow this one, which will just cover that final with commentary from the game and a tale from the Celtic Wiki coverage of that game. And with that, I will say St. Anthony and Robert, thanks very much. As I record this, I'm watching another amazing European night involving Celtic Football Club. It's the night that we beat Barcelona 2-1 with goals from Victor Wanyama and Tony Watt. The second half is just after on BT Sport as I'm watching it. So if you've got some sort of BT Sport player, go back and have a look at that. Anyway, hope you enjoyed the podcast. Obviously, coming up next is season 67-68. Which is quite a remarkable season. We lose early in the European Cup, and obviously there is the World Club Championship debacle, battle, whatever you want to describe it. Anyway, I hope everyone's keeping safe, doing only essential journeys, washing your hands, doing everything right. We'll be through this one day, and we'll all be back at Celtic Park singing You'll Never Walk Alone and enjoying the world's best football club. Anyway, that was season 66-67. There will be a podcast along very soon which just features the goals and detail from the cup final. But that was St. Anthony and Robert, and this is me, Harry Bailey, saying good night, God bless, and take care. Good night.